IsraelScene.com. Michael Kagan, what's on your mind these days?
Hi, Yoram. It's good to be back on the show. Well, I thought that we should start with the upcoming festival of Shavuot. As you may or may not know, Shavuot has many faces. The first one that comes to mind is giving of Torah. Matan Torateinu, the giving of our Torah. And that occurs 50 days after coming out of Egypt. We cross the Red Sea, we cross into Sinai, we get to the mountain. Right? We all know the story. Moses goes up on the mountain, God descends, comes down with the Ten Commandments, breaks the Ten Commandments. We go into the next cycle of things. But that is the giving of Torah, a momentous event. It says that God came down. I mean, that's whatever that means. I really don't know what that means, but there was some touching of heaven and earth, some bending of the dimensions, and the Torah was given. But that's only the historical face of Shavuot. We know that Shavuot is associated with the harvest festivals, with the Book of Ruth, with the giving of the Omer in Yerushalayim, with a pilgrimage up the mountain, the other mountain, the mountain of Yerushalayim. And it takes on a very, very land-focused holiday. As does the other holidays, but in particularly, Shavuot is associated with the wheat harvest, and is very integral to the season of the year that we're right now approaching. But there are other aspects of Shavuot that I want to touch upon now, and from there we'll go into a wider discussion of Judaism, ecology, environment, and things like that. There are two main traditions on Shavuot, other than staying up all night learning, and that is to eat non-meat products. Now, for those people who are carnivores like myself, who enjoy meat once in a while, Shavuot comes along, a major festival, the families together, and the emphasis is on milk products. Cheesecake in particular, and I make a great cheesecake, you should know that. And the other aspect is we put greenery in the synagogues, plants, trees. I remember as a child, growing up in London, this enormous synagogue I was part of, stained glass windows, very cathedral-like. And comes Shavuot, and all around the galleries there are rhododendrons and other green plants that are put there. And in many other synagogues, you cut down leaves from trees or branches from trees, and you decorate the Aron Kodesh, where the Torah scrolls are kept, covered with green things. And there's this green aspect. Why? Okay, it's very strange. Why? Why milk? Why green? Many explanations of both, but I want to pose a particular one, which is an area of interest of mine at the moment. There is a verse right at the beginning of the Torah when it describes the creation process. And it was day one, and it was day two, and it was day three, and it was day four, and it was day five, and it was the sixth day. Yom HaShishi, that's the way we start Kiddush on Friday nights. Sanctification of the day, we start on Friday nights. Yom HaShishi. There's the definitive article before the numeral. And that's different from all other days of the creation. So the question is asked, what is the sixth day? Why isn't it day number six? And Rashi, the great medieval commentator, quotes a midrash that says, it's referring to the sixth day, a special sixth day, and that is the sixth day of the month of Sivan. And what is the sixth day of the month of Sivan? Shavuot, the giving of Torah, which occurs right in a couple of days' time. What is he talking about? How can, at the beginning of creation, have in mind the sixth day of Sivan? There were no Jews there, right? There was no Israel, there was no festivals, there was no history. There was just the creation of the heaven and the earth. So Rashi answers that question himself in a particular way, and he says the creation was not complete until the sixth day, the giving of the Torah, thousands, millions, trillions of years later, on the sixth day of Sivan, when the Jews congregated around the mountain, Moses went up, God came down and said, ah, this is the completion of this cycle of creation. Now it starts again, so to speak. Right? Now take this and start the next round of creation. And I take it the opposite way. And I said, on Shavuot, on the day of the Torah being given, we connect back to the Garden of Eden. We connect back to that pristine time of creation, or just after creation, where things were different, very, very different. And we lived in this harmony with nature, and I'm now not pretending that our physical path was like that, but I'm talking about our spiritual path in the way that the Torah sets it up, that there was a garden, and there was a way of living in that garden that was very, very different to the way that we live in relationship to the earth today. We didn't kill animals to eat. We took milk, and they replenished their milk. We took of the fruit of the trees and whatever else was available in a sensible and sustained manner. And we lived in this paradise, pardes, this paradise. And then we left. Things broke and we left, and the rest of history we know. And Shavuot, we have this opportunity to pass back over that bridge. That bridge appears in psycho-spiritual space. And we can walk across and go back to a time where everything was green and we were back in the garden and we don't kill animals to eat and we don't plunder the earth and we return to that pristine state of relationship between Hamakom, meaning God, and the Makom, meaning the place that we stand on. You see, place and place. Makom, makom, is the same word for describing God. And that's something that we lost. And on Shavuot, in the historical Shavuot, that's when God comes back down. He says, okay, I'm now here with you again. I can't stay with you for long, but take my Torah, and that will be my encapsulation, so to speak, that you can carry with you. And my Mishkan, my tabernacle, that you will carry with you. And so I will be with you on your journeys, not the way it used to be, not the way it was back then in the garden when I would walk and chat and stroll with you in the evening, have tea on the lawn, you know. So Shavuot is a tremendous time for remembering that, re-experiencing that, just even if it's just with our palates. Actually, you know, while I say it, it's more than just the palates. We actually stay up all night learning, going back to trying to hear that original voice from Sinai that takes us back to that original relationship that we had back at the beginning. So what I've described up to now is Shavuot being a festival embedded in history, the giving of the Torah, that moved us into the land of Israel, and which we keep as a land festival. Nature festival, and all the time it takes us back to the garden. Now there is another direction, which is to the future of Messiah, whatever that means. It's not going back to the garden. The doorway to the garden is closed and sealed, protected by an angel with a fiery sword. That's not the way to go. It's like saying, well, I want to go back to my mum's womb, right? Doors closed. The only way is forwards. Now, we may get back to mother, but a different kind of mother in a different way, in a spiral, but you can't go backwards. There's no going backwards. So I want to read now from the prophet Hoshea, and give you a taste of his vision of what it can be like. And I mention this because it's not as wild as Isaiah, where he says, and the sheep will lay down with the wolf, and the child will play with the asp. Okay, I want you to listen to this. It's quite profound. And it shall be on that day, the word of the Lord, of Hashem, that you will call me Ishi, my husband. Ishi, my husband. You will no longer call me Baali, my master. Ishi is my man, right? My man, my husband, my partner. You will no longer call me Baali. Now, what are we talking about here? What is he talking about? Well, in Hebrew, a woman calls her husband Baali. And I call my landlord Baal Hadira.
We know the word Baal from the Bible as being one of the idolatrous characters that were being sacrificed to. As part of the pagan tradition and ritual, don't we?
Yes, it was a Canaanite god. So here we have a Canaanite god that we conquered Canaan, but everyone fell back all the time, back into worshipping Baal, okay, a false god, a god that didn't create at the beginning and didn't give Torah, a false god. And somehow, and this is very, very odd, the word Baal crept into common usage in our language to refer to a lord. Not the lord, but a lord of flesh and blood.
Lord of the manor.
Lord of the manor, lord of my house, right? My balabait is the person who owns my house, so I pay rent to.
My employer, does it also work?
My employer? Boss, but it would be the same kind of thing, yes. And a woman calls her husband Baali, my lord and master, right? My lord and master. And even though today that relationship doesn't exist, I'm not my wife's lord. Okay, it's not. Okay, we've passed that stage, thank God. Nevertheless, the term is still there. And so here comes the prophet with his great, great vision of the future.
Vision dates back a few years.
It dates back certainly a few years. I would say Hoshea was about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. 2,500 would probably be right. Second temple time. Sorry, first temple. First temple time. Just after the first temple time, when Israel is turning towards other gods, and Hoshea uses the woman as the metaphor for the wickedness of Israel turning to other gods, the infidelity of Israel. So he says, at the end of days, there will be a change of mentality. And no longer will a woman call her husband Baali, my master, but Ishi, my man. My man. And that, I mean, that you could say is happening now. Even though in the Hebrew language, nobody says, who is she? People are beginning to. My wife tries to introduce me as, Ze Ishi. That's my man. And that's my woman. Okay, and we are partners. And we're not far away from this time where that word will be wiped out. Baali will be wiped out, in reference to the relationship between a husband and wife. But then he goes on, and he said, "And I will seal, and I will remove the names of the Baalim from her mouth, and they will not be mentioned again by their name." So all this Baalut, Baal, this mastership, this lordship that is not of divine, but is of our own creation, will disappear. We will no longer use this term. But it's referring not just to the word, but the concept, obviously. "And I will seal a covenant from them on that day with the beast of the field, and the bird of the heavens, and the creeping thing of the ground. And I will banish bow and sword and warfare from the land, and I will lay them down in safety." So you hear an echo of Isaiah here, "And I will lay them down in safety." But there is a difference, and I'll get to that difference in a minute. And then comes the very, very famous verses that we say every day when we put on tefillin, and we say in a wedding, "And I will betroth you to me forever, and I will betroth you to me with righteousness, with justice, with kindness, and with mercy. And I will betroth you to me with fidelity, and you will know God." And you will know God. And this intimate relationship, it will not be with Baal, with the Lord, it will be with God, Hashem. Completely different kind of relationship. "And it will be on that day that I will respond." This is the word of Hashem, the Lord, the God. "I will respond to the heavens, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond with the grain and the wine and the oil. And they will respond to Jezreel," which is the valley, a beautiful, fertile valley, not far from here. So what is this about? I want to take it not just on the relationship between a husband and a wife, in which the name will change from my lord and master to my partner, my man. But I think here he's clearly pointing out our relationship to the earth will change. No longer will it be that I am the lord of this land, which is the way we lord ourselves on this earth right now. All land, I mean the earth as the land that we live on, it's very much the state of affairs today that I own the land. It is mine. I am the lord and master, not only of my wife, my children, my maidservants, my manservants, but my land as well and everything that is on it. And I do what I want with it because I'm the master. It's mine. So along comes Hoshea and says, no, this has to change. And it will change. It will be a return to a relationship with the land that is not that of lord and master over a dumb animal or a dumb producer of whatever it is, whether it's workers in a factory or the land that produces its fruit and harvest. There's going to be a change, and that change refers back to the way it used to be, to the way it must be, and that's the crisis that we're facing today. In the relationship that we have with each other, lording it over each other, the developed nations over the less developed nations, over the underdeveloped nations, over the suppressed nations, etc., lording it over, to the way I treat my garden, my land, my resources, to my children, to my wife, to myself and to my body. So there's going to be this change from Baalut. And in fact, this Baalut, this Baal, this false god, this false way of living, the prophet says will disappear. Will it be done by miracles from above? I don't think so. I think it's incumbent upon us to do this with divine insight and the relationship that is built by binding ourselves to God Almighty. This, it's sort of a relationship. I take a step and that takes a step. I take a step and that relationship in the vertical plane gets strengthened as I take a step in the horizontal plane to make a difference.
I must say, Michael, what you've just read and what you've been discussing takes the word prophet right out of the area of abstract long time ago, no longer has anything to do much with us, and brings it right to the here and now.
What I just read to you is so contemporary. It's so talking about the problems we're facing now in the paradigm shifts that are going on between male and female, between us and the earth, between us and spirituality. It's just an amazing piece. And let me go on a little bit. I want to relate a little bit more from Torah to this idea of the end of Ba'alut, lording it over. You know, this year is a very special year that occurs every 7 years, and that is the year of Shemitah, sabbatical year. It's very difficult to keep today. When I drive down from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, when you get to the plains there on the left side, there is a field that is totally wasted. I mean, it's just like nothing's growing there. And they have a big poster saying, "We keep Shemitah," okay? Which means the land is left fallow. Not touched, not planted. It does not give. We don't take. And there's many reasons for that. And on the other side is the sunflowers, and after that is the airport. Yes. So on one side, people are making money, and on the other side, people are watching and maybe learning this year. That was what it said that they traditionally did. They took the year off, went to university and learned, went to yeshiva and learned, traveled the world. I don't know what the farmers are doing. It would be very interesting to go and interview people in that area. Well, what are you doing this year if you're not working from daybreak to sunset as a farmer, breaking your back and doing all whatever you do? So what are you doing this year? That would be very, very interesting to find out. But it's important to stress that the reason why the sabbatical year occurs is not to let the fields lie fallow as in the times of medieval England, for instance, which I remember learning about, in which one year one field, and the next year the next field, and the next year the next field, and they take turns, this cyclic crop rotation system, to allow the earth to replenish. I mean, that happens on the Shemitah year. It happens. But think of it this way. All the fields are lying fallow in one year. Six out of your seven fields, or one out of your 20 fields. But all of it. There is no work. And I'm not a farmer, and I don't appreciate that much, but even in my little garden here next to the house, I'm not working in there. It's not growing wild. There are rules and regulations of what I am allowed to do and not allowed to do. I can tend the garden just to keep it in order without it going totally wild, but no more than that. And I have fruit trees. And on Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, I give up my ba'alut, my ownership of my own garden. And if you want to take of the fruit of the tree there, you have every right to walk into my garden, pick, and take it. I can't say, "Hey, what are you doing? That's mine." No, it's not mine. It's ours. It's not even, it's everybody's. So that's the rules for Shemitah. There are many others. What happens to things that do grow, perennials, annuals? But this idea of my house, my garden, the wall around my garden with a gate of which I have the key, and no one comes into my garden and takes of the fruit of my tree, goes. Now, it's very, very difficult because of economic situation to expect all the farmers in this entire country to stop working and there'd be no produce, and we would have to get it just from non-Jewish farmers, the local Arabs, or import, which is today even worse, importing all our food from somewhere else and let them work instead of us. So I'm not sure that Shemitah, in the way it's formulated in the Torah, is viable today on a physical plane. But as we saw from Hoshea, what I think it can be understood as referring to is much more on our attitude towards. Our attitude towards the land, to my garden, to my trees, my fruit, my house, everything that I spoke of before, is in the framework of Shemitah, all described there. Now, Torah then goes even further. So it says, so you like your house? It's a nice house. How long have you been living in this house? 40 years? 47 years? 49 years? 50 years? Wow. I got news for you. It's time to leave and let the previous owners, original owners, come back. What are you talking about? I've been here. My children grew up here. My grandchildren have grown up. This is my house. I paid off the mortgage. I built the walls. I redecorated it. It was a mess when I found it. And I remember, you know, all that I invested in this house and my memories. And it's my house. I am the Baal, the master of this house. And along comes Torah and says, well, every 50 years, nope. It goes back to the previous owner. Now, it so happens that the house that you and I are right now recording in, my house, is an Arab house. And it belonged to Arab owners, maybe Turkish, I'm not sure, before 1948 war. And this area was the seam between Jordan and Israel. After that war, and this was a very, very rundown neighborhood then. Now it's a real up-and-coming Anglo, high real estate, high-value area. But this is an Arab house with the tall ceilings and the beautiful decor and two great palm trees at the front. Well, what would happen if somebody knocked at the door and said, this is my house? Then I would have to call up my ancestors, and they would knock on the door and say, yes, but it's my house from way back, and their ancestors, until you get to the tribes and you go back to an original state, which also mirrors the Garden of Eden. When we came into the land, we conquered it, we took it over, we settled. That was sort of, now we'll start again. This is, you know, the game starts again now, and this is the system, this is the way it's going to be. And so you go back to that original ownership. Is that a good place to start? I don't know. What about the people who we conquered? I mean, what happens if they come to us? Well, you got to start somewhere. But this is not the point. The point is that the idea of Jubilee, the Jubilee year, the Yovel, is to impress upon me, it's not mine. I am not the Baal. I'm not the Lord of this manor. And it says in the section of the Torah that we read just 3 weeks ago, Bahar, the mountain, for the earth belongs to me, says the Lord. It's mine. And you must remember that all the time. So I am giving you a lease, but never forget that I am the true Adon, the master of the world. I am the creator of the world and all belongs to me. You can lease it, you can look after it, just like I have a lease on, not on this particular house, but on other places. I can't go around destroying it. It's not mine. It belongs to the landlord. So it is with the earth. And that is the message that comes through again and again and again in all kinds of areas in our tradition. Remember that God is the master, not me. I am just here tending the garden, trying to keep it going, feeding myself in relationship to everything that's going on.
So it occurs to me one of the more popular quotes from the Bible that's used certainly in the United States in the Christian world and to a degree in the Jewish world is from Bereshit, where we're told the translation is that God has given dominion of the land to the human beings, to the two-leggers. Is that a misquote? Is that a misunderstanding? Is that word, can that word be thought of differently?
Well, first of all, in the story of creation, in the early chapters of Bereshit, there's also that we have to protect the earth. Yes, we're the guardians of the earth. I always wondered to me, guardians of what exactly? I mean, if we weren't here, what would happen? I mean, it's a good question, right? What if we weren't here? What would need guarding? I mean, lions need to be guarded against the deer. Well, in the zoos they are, but they're not happy. No, I said that wrong, didn't I?
But it works both ways.
Do the deer need to be protected from the lions? So is that our role, to protect the deer from the lions? Well, we haven't done a very good job at that because we kill the deer and we kill the lions.
Well, the lions would starve.
And the lions would starve. So if I was a conservationist, I would, well, what would I do? I would protect the deers from the lions and let the lions starve, or I would let everyone get on and do their job. I think what we have to protect ourselves from, no, I gave it away. What we have to protect is ourselves from the damage that we can do to the planet. And I think that that is what Torah is talking about. I'm going to put you on this planet. You can walk it, you can talk it, you can plant, you can take of the fruit, but be careful, because you have the potential to destroy it. And that's what you have to guard against. Your potential to destroy this planet. And there is a very old ancient midrash that says, look after the planet, for if you destroy it, there's no one going to fix it. That's it. You have one chance at this. You destroy it, I'm not coming to fix it. So that's a tremendous responsibility, not to fix the planet. The planet doesn't need fixing. But after we're here for a while, the planet definitely needs fixing. So another, so a way of understanding those particular words that you quoted just now is not to have dominion over, but it actually, lichvosh can also mean preserve, as in preservatives. Okay, so pickle cucumbers and things like that. In other words, there is a sense of preserving, not of dominating. But at the same time, God does say, but you can spread out. You can fill the earth from east to west, from north to south. You can do that. I give you permission. Few other creatures can do that. Everyone has their own eco-niche. We are one of the few creatures on the planet that can go anywhere. We can be in the North Pole, the South Pole, in the Sahara, even in England, right? We can be all over these places, and somehow we make it on volcanoes, on fault lines, on in jungles. I mean, if you think about it, the adaptability of humans above and beyond almost any other creature, probably only bacteria. No, I don't think, maybe mosquitoes, flies maybe. Mosquitoes need particular temperature, okay? One of the fears today, Al Gore's film points this out, is as the temperature of the earth or parts of the earth rises, so mosquitoes can now live higher up the mountains. So towns and villages that were built above the mosquito line are suddenly finding themselves infested by mosquitoes. And last year I was in Innsbruck in Austria in September, and I went to a hotel, I tried to go to sleep, and there were mosquitoes everywhere. All night I was killing mosquitoes, mamash. And in the morning I had hardly slept. I went to the Balha Beit Malon, the lord of the hotel, and I said, I'm not paying. How could you put me into a place? He didn't give me a warning, he didn't give me a spray, nothing. He says, you're right, but this is the second time in the entire history of Innsbruck that we've ever had mosquitoes. The other time was the night before. We don't have mosquitoes here. And I thought, wow, this stuff's getting real. I mean, the mosquito line is going up. They're going up the mountain. So we can live above mosquitoes. So we can live even where mosquitoes can't live. And this adaptability is part of the genius of the human species, the ability to create tools, to make buildings, to create energy or convert energy, allows us to live in all kinds of places, even the most dangerous places, and get wiped out by an earthquake, and there we come back again, fertile soil now, whatever. Unbelievable. So we were given permission, so to speak, by God at the beginning to spread out. It's okay, says God, you can spread out, and you can be everywhere. Just be careful. Be careful. Not to ruin it. I want to take this conversation now in a slightly different direction and to relate to more to the work that I'm doing. And I'm going to take us down a step before we get into the nitty-gritties to talk a little bit more theory and then see if we can put it together. A book that I was introduced to by our good friend Rabbi David Zeller, Zichron Livracha, may his memory be a blessing to us all, was a book by Daniel Quinn called Ishmael, which has a strange title, Ishmael. It's not about the biblical character Ishmael, and it's not about the conflict in the Middle East between the Ishmaelites, the Arab Muslims, and the Isaac followers, right, the Jews. Nothing about that. It's about a gorilla that is highly intelligent, that has a message for humanity about the dangers that we are imposing upon the planet and the way that the planet will probably defend itself and get rid of us. And the whole book is a discussion between a human, a not particularly bright human in my opinion, and an extremely intelligent gorilla. And the gorilla paints a picture of human culture as being divided between two groups or two phases in history. One is what we call prehistory, and the other one is called our history. And in school, I remember, I used to learn prehistory, and then we used to go into history classes. And, you know, until I read Quinn, I hadn't thought about that. What is prehistory? I mean, how can there be a prehistory to what? So Quinn says a prehistory to our civilization that we, as being part of that civilization, define as history. And anything that comes outside of our civilization is called the prehistory to our civilization. Not another history, but a prehistory. Because there is really only one history, ours. As they say, history is written by the victors. So what was prehistory in Quinn's analogy? It was everything that occurred before the agricultural revolution, when humans lived on the earth as hunter-gatherers, as nomads, traveling the world without fixed cities, without cars, without houses, without ba'alut, without this is mine, get off my land, I will kill you. It doesn't mean that the tribes that wandered around didn't fight each other over resources, but they moved on. We're growing, we need this, we need that, and you're imposing. But it wasn't this from the sense of, I own this square of land, I'm building a wall around it, and here's the gate, it's my key, and I'm keeping the key close to me, keep out. Now, I'm not trying to say that Quinn is historically accurate in all its pieces and parts. But there was definitely a time, and the time is disputed amongst historians, about when the agricultural revolution took place. Maybe 6,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. It didn't happen suddenly, it happened gradually, it didn't happen just here, it happened in many places. But let's just look at one aspect of the agricultural revolution, which is it occurred between 6,000 and 10,000 years ago, maybe a little bit more. One of the places it occurred was the Fertile Crescent. Here. Well, not actually here in Israel, but further into Iraq, along the banks of the Euphrates and the Tigris River, which is understandable because there was so much water there. Global warming, Earth was much warmer in those days than it is now. And there's quite many books on this subject written, and some of them are, you know, on my bookshelf. So what happened was that humans learned tools that could manipulate nature by digging a canal and bringing more water to this area than the river would normally bring. And once there was water, then they began to see, well, more water, more crops. And if I have more water, I can grow crops more intensively. I can then support a bigger population. And then, as the population grew, they needed more land and better techniques for growing more food to support a growing population. And then the population grew. And the cycle goes on, and he calls it totalitarian agriculture. Because as the population grows, you have to supply food for that population. Nothing gets in the way of that. So it spread extremely rapidly, exponentially, as the population grew. So the land conquered for the purposes of agriculture grew rapidly, coming out of the Fertile Crescent down to the Nile Delta, across to Greece, up through Asia Minor, until very, very fast, the majority of areas in which humans dwelt was devoted to agriculture, and the life of the nomad and the hunter-gatherer dwindled, until, according to Quinn, and I think this is pretty accurate, 98 approximately percent of human activity today is concerned with agriculture, and 2% is the rewind. So according to Quinn, there were two clashing forces, and he calls one the levers. That was the previous one, in which you would have a nomad and you would leave this piece of land and move on to another piece of land and move on to another piece of land and move on to you had your little garden, and the women were in charge of planting and reaping, and that's how women knew about the secrets of healing from the garden. And the men would go out to hunt and to gather and to do all that stuff. And those were called the levers. And he romanticizes it a little bit, you know, and they knew how to leave things alone. They knew the pulse of history. They knew the pulse of nature. They felt the seasons, and they knew when to move and to pack up. And you can see this in a lot of the contemporary literature on Native Americans. Not so long ago.
Or Tibetans.
And today, he says, that group of people, that civilization, he calls it a civilization, is reduced to about 2%. 98% of the world are this other civilization coming out of the agricultural revolution, which he calls the takers. I take this land for me. I take this for me. This is mine. Consumerism, I take it. And he calls it totalitarian. And nothing stood in its way. And we can see that in history of the last 200 years. You don't have to go back anymore. Look what the whites, takers, coming from Europe, did to the Great Plains of America. Where's the buffalo roaming now? It wiped out the entire nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyle there, and instead replaced it with crops. So until recently, those crops were the food basket of the world, especially America, but also for the rest of the world. And now it's turned into bio oil to drive the cars of those people who can afford them. I mean, that's, you know, you've got to think about that. The breadbasket of America is turning into biofuel. People will be starving so other people can drive their cars. So we have levers and takers. Takers rule the planet. Levers are leftover. A few tribes left in the jungle. There was something on the BBC the other day that they found a new tribe. First time ever spotted, photographed from the air. With our knowledge today of what kind of diseases we people, takers, will give to levers, no one is allowed into that area of the jungle because we will kill them just by our diseases. We know what happened to Native Americans and many, many other lever societies, Aboriginal societies, when they met Western man, didn't have the ability either physically or immune system to resist us and wiped out. And a new tribe was found last week. One, you know, little island left. So what do I think about leavers and takers? I mean, who's better, leavers or takers? I don't think that's the question. I'm certainly not prepared to be a leaver. I'm not going to go back and try and struggle with my goats and travel. And I'm not. That's not for me, and nor it is for the billions of people on this planet. We've gone past that stage. I want to relate it to Bible, and we'll then see how it fits together. Where are the leavers and the takers in the Bible? And when David Zeller, Rabbi David Zeller, introduced me to the book and I read it, I was left with that question. Wait a minute, 6,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, Fertile Crescent? But that's when our history started as Jews. Are we the goodies or the baddies here? Are we the leavers or are we takers? I mean, who are we? And Quinn actually discusses Bible in his books and presents a beautiful parable. We know that it describes Adam and Eve, and that they had two sons, Cain and Abel. Do you remember what their professions were? Well, Abel was the shepherder, and Cain was the farmer. And Cain rose up and killed his brother. And he takes that as a parable for the rise of the agricultural revolution to destroy the previous one, the leavers. He killed it. And we now come from Cain. So we are the taker society. But he was wrong. Or rather, not wrong, but he forgot something. There was another son. After Abel died, Adam knew his wife once more, and they had another son, Seth. And it's that one, the third way, which we trace as Jews, that we come from. Now, not exclusively, they had sons and sons of sons and sons of sons, but there was something about the third son that's different from leavers and takers. What am I trying to say? I mentioned before the fact that we can't go back to the garden. The Garden of Eden story, one can understand perhaps as the prehistory, the history of the leavers. Not idyllic, but living in the garden, the planet Earth, coping this way and that way, doing a bit of damage, perhaps repairing it, maybe not enough to do a lot of damage. Somehow, symbiotic relationship with the planet. And then things change. We ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, meaning things. We learned how to use the land, how to make plows, and we began to plow the land. And it says right at the beginning, after the exit, after the what's called the fall or the leaving of the garden, and cities began. It says it right there, and cities began around the Fertile Crescent. Population explosion, you can read it there, and this one begat, you know, God knows how many children. There was a population explosion, urban society grew, agricultural grew, metal was learnt to be utilized and pounded into plowshares
and swords.
Women moved off the land because the heavy plows could now only be handled by men. So women got reduced to being in the house or attending the little garden. Not the bigger garden, the little garden.
I think you need to differentiate between the garden and the farm.
Garden and the farm, right. We began to have farms and gardens, right. And, you know, I lived with Native Americans, and I learned the ways of planting there. You take a stick and you make a hole. You put in a seed. You move on. You make a. That's the garden. And you grow your maize, and then you have your corn, and that sustains you a little bit. Okay, but mass intensive farming that takes place over the Great Plains today and in many other areas of the world was new. It's just new, and it required skill and animals and heavy plows. So that's the new stage that the Torah really spends most of its time talking about. After leaving the garden, now what? And I think if you look at Judaism and the Jewish tradition, the question arises, as it did when I read the book, are we leavers or are we takers? I mean, which side are we? I mean, Jews seem to be so involved with business in the world. Are we connectors? Are we connected? Well, you'll see in a minute, you know. Very nice, okay? So, look what it says in the Torah. When Joseph brought his brothers down to Egypt, right, after that whole story, he says, I want to introduce you to Pharaoh. But know that you are an abomination here in Egypt because we are ranchers. We're nomads. We're considered by the locals as an abomination. Why? The typical answer is because the sheep and goats that we tended were the gods of Egypt, and
they eat in the garden, and they eat in the farm, and they eat the farmer's produce, okay, because they wander. Okay. The farmer stands still, his produce stands still, the corn can't run away, but the goat comes to the corn.
Ah, okay. So there is a conflict there. Okay, so there is a conflict between what food am I going to give to my goats and my sheep and my standing food, the corn, and I've got to separate the two. As I was saying, traditionally there is an understanding that the goats and the sheep were the gods of Egypt. There's no evidence of that. There's really no evidence in Egyptology that gods were of goats or sheep. What it shows is this was the old conflict between the previous ways of the levers, of which we were, and the agricultural revolution. And you can see, keep your sheep off my land. Abraham, dear old Abraham, how did he start his life? He was an urbanite. He lived in Nineveh or Ur-Kasdim in Babylon somewhere. And even though it's not written directly in Torah what kind of a person he had, we have many midrashim that paint this picture, that he was petit bourgeois. His father had a shop in which he sold pictures of deities, okay, and statues and all that kind of stuff. And that Abraham was a philosophy major, failed philosophy major. And something happened to Abraham. And he heard, he got the voice of the Lord, the word of the Lord came to him. And he left all that life and went back to nature. God said, I will take you out of this place, out of this land, and I will take you to another place, another land, another way of living. You know what? You've got to leave all your books, leave them behind, all your possessions, leave them behind. You're going to become a nomad. You're going back to being levers. Now, I know I said before you can never go back, but that's what happened to Abraham. He went back to being levers. Our forefathers were levers. We were all shepherds. We went down to Egypt where they hated us because we were like the Bedouin in the south, okay, the Native American in America, the gypsies all over Europe. And the Egyptians hated us for that, and we had to keep ourselves separate. But after generations, we began to integrate, as we always do so well, and we became more Egyptian than the Egyptians. And then along comes God and says, you know what? I'm getting you out of here. Okay? First of all, I make you slaves, so you know what real ba'alut is. Okay? Real masters over. And that's not what I want. But you've got to experience what I don't want before you can experience what I do want. So we went through slavery, and then we were taken out back into being nomads. The 40 years of the desert, which is not quite nomads, although we had our animals and all this, but God provided. So we didn't have to scrounge for food and for water and for pasture lands. The manna was provided, but the experience of being weaned off Egyptian life and civilization, coming back to Abraham life, was right there. Learning how to trust in God, learning that God is the master. God provides and God takes. God gives and God takes. And that was our experience for 40 years in the desert, in order to prepare us to go into the next phase. Now, what was the next phase? Becoming agriculturalists, building towns and cities in our newly conquered land, or the promised land. Don't want to offend anybody here. But something's different. We were told by God, given permission, you can now become takers. Ah, but you're not really takers. You're fooling everyone. You're fooling everybody. It's only going to appear like you're takers, but you're really not. How do we know? Because our entire tradition is filled with leaving it alone. Okay, give me an example. Something that we have to leave alone. Corners of the field. Now, I ask you, is there any farmer in the world who goes to all the bother of sowing and then doesn't reap the corners of the field? I mean, that's absurd. Jewish law says, biblical law says, leave the corners alone. Not only that, you're collecting the wheat and a sheaf falls on the floor. You cannot turn around and pick it up. It's like Lot's wife. You remember? Lot's wife. She turns around, finished. Okay? You leave it alone. And this brings us to Shavuot, because that's how the book of Ruth is built. She goes out to gather the wheat, and the leavings of the wheat. And all the women, the poor, would follow the reapers, and inevitably things drop. And Boaz says, let some more drop. You know, just, you know, fake it. Drop. It's okay. We got enough. And they would be there and they would gather. What else? Where else is leaving primary in Judaism? We already mentioned Shemitah. Every 6 years, on the seventh year, leave the field alone. What, are you crazy? How am I going to live? How are any of us going to live? No, no, no. It's okay. I'll look after you. I will provide. That's right. You will get double, like Shabbat. Oh, Shabbat, did I say? Now, what is Shabbat if not the quintessential leave it alone? But wait a minute. I have a business going here, and I got to get the contracts out on, you know, the seventh day. Don't tell me about leaving. My business is going to go under. Trust me. Your business won't go under. Your family, you know, is worth more than that. Leave it alone. Just leave it alone. Don't even put on the electricity. Just leave it alone. Leave it alone. Don't cook. Don't reap. Don't plow. Don't sow. Don't this. Don't fix. Don't fix. Don't fix. Don't plunder. Don't. Just be here. Just be here. Stop doing. Just be here. Leave it alone. What an amazing thing. And this Shabbos, Shabbat, the Sabbath day, is the core of our entire religion. Everything spins out of that. Everything is to remind us about Shabbat. What's the day called? Today is Yom Revi'i, the fourth day of the week. And we say in the morning prayers, there is a psalm allotted to each day. And today it says, Hayom Yom Revi'i B'Shabbat. Today is the fourth day B means in Shabbat. That doesn't make sense. Wait a minute. It should have said, Hayom Yom Revi'i M'Shabbat. This is the fourth day from Shabbat, right? You have Shabbat, first day, second day, third day, fourth day. No, but it doesn't say that. It says B'Shabbat, in Shabbat. In other words, it's always Shabbat. Today is Shabbat. And tomorrow is Shabbat.
And yesterday
was Shabbat. But we're not ready to keep it like that yet. And there is a prophecy that the day will come when it will all be Shabbat. So on Shabbat, it's definitely Shabbat. And we do all these things to remind us of what life is truly about, which is leaving it alone. It's not mine. This is the prophet Hoshea. I am not the Baal. On Shabbat, I'm definitely not the Baal, the master. It's God's world. But God says, you know what? I want you to remember this, but I want you to live like takers, because otherwise they're going to wipe you out. And you can't survive unless I put you on a little island somewhere or in the middle of jungle. It's true, but the leavers in the jungles somehow have managed.
The question is, do you have to take everything?
Do you have to take everything, right? And can you leave things alone? Our society, it's very difficult to leave things alone. Okay, you know, the tape recorder that you have, there's a new version coming out now that's just so much better. What, there's nothing wrong with your one? Doesn't matter. There's a new one. Throw it away and take a new one. Okay, but there's nothing wrong with the other one. It's okay. Take a new one. And our consumerism indoctrinates us from a very young age that new is better. New you must have. New you must have. So I don't want to go, I'm not a prophet of doom, and I'm not a everything that's new is bad. I'm not saying that. And this is where I want to move to. It's very important to get this point. What then is Judaism? Well, it's not taker, because of everything I've described. The hard wiring of our system is the previous civilization, which is leavers. But we're acting like takers. We are leavers. And there's the third son. What I maintain is that we are actually a third way. It's neither levers, because that's going back, and we're not going to be able to rewind the clock. We cannot survive that way, and the planet will just not be able to provide for it. Whether it can provide as takers, I don't know. But that's the crunch that's approaching now. Is there a third way? And I believe that Judaism actually presents us with an economic structure, a way of being psychologically and spiritually and physically on this earth that is neither taker nor leaver. I call it givers, sharers. Now in Kabbalah, just if you want to move in that direction just to get some visuals here, there is two polarities, the left side and the right side. The right side is called Netzach, which is the conqueror. The left side is called Hod, which is very much contracting, not expanding, contracting. And then you have the middle. So I like to think that Netzach is takers, which is very, very expansionist. Hod are the levers, which is very much contracted, small, small groups, wanderers, leaving it alone. There's the third way, the way of Seth, the third brother, which is right down the middle, which is the bridge between them. It's not just the point somewhere between these two. It's actually Yesod, which is below that, which is a new way that combines both of them into something new. And I'm being a little vague here because I don't actually know what it is. Okay, all I know is that that's what we have to be searching for now.
Kibbutz at one point was an example of an attempt at reaching a balance between taking and leaving, and the phrase that was used is to receive what you need and to give what you have to offer, so that you achieved a balance between what you took and what you gave.
Yes, I would agree. In one of Daniel Quinn's books, he writes, how do you know if your society is a taker society or a leaver society? He said, well, imagine waking up in the middle of the night hungry, and you open up your larder and there's no food there. So you go up the road, and at the top of my road there's a makolet, a store. Is it open? Well, now you have 24-hour ones, okay. But no, it's locked. Middle of the night, it's locked. But there's food there, and I'm hungry. And I need to eat, but it's locked. And in order to access that food that I need, I have to wait, and then I have to pay. In order to pay, I have to work. And if I don't have a job, I can't pay. And it's owned by the owner of the store, who has to get the money and buy it from, and you have the whole supply chain. I remember living on kibbutz. I remember this so clearly, waking up in the middle of the night, I'm hungry. Well, the room that I was in didn't have a kitchen because it was communal living. And I would cross the lawn and go into the chadar ochel, the communal dining room, and open up the big fridge, walk inside, take a loaf of bread, take some butter, take some cheese, make a sandwich, eat, clear up after myself, put what I've not used back in the fridge, close the big door, cross the lawn. There were no keys. There was no locks. There was no mess. That's the way he was. The system failed because of many reasons, but you could be right that that may be the way of the future, or maybe a way that we can learn about
the
future.
Only way we can have a future.
So Yoram says it's the only way we can have a future. I don't know exactly what, if you want, Shabbat economic theory is going to present to us on a large scale. Certainly Daniel Quinn, in a book called Beyond Civilization, talks about the kibbutz and these coming together in communal living. But I'm not postulating that yet. I don't know. What I do know is the prophet Hoshea that I read earlier says that what must change is the attitude of Baalut, this false god of my ownership of the planet, my ownership of everything on the planet, and my doing whatever I want to the planet for my own good. And this is idol worship. That must change.
Okay, Michael, that's all well and good. Now what are we going to do? Now we know what you're thinking about. Now what are we doing about?
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask that. One of the things that I personally have done now is to set up with a group of friends an organization called the Jewish Climate Initiative for Tikkun HaOlam, fixing of the world. And this is a Jewish-based organization, not just an organization of Jews, in which we are mining the huge wealth of wisdom literature that we have in our tradition, to try and understand what does Judaism have to say, what does Judaism postulate for a better way of relating to our planet, ourselves, our resources. A number of books have already been written on this subject, but we feel that there is so much more, and that the work that has been done up till now is just touching the tip of the iceberg. And so we're setting up a research institute now in Israel. We're looking for funding for that, in which we will start exploring the theory. We have other projects. For instance, in Judaism, the symbol of the tree is very central. There is a verse in Deuteronomy, man is like a tree in the field. And that's all to do within the context of you do not destroy fruit trees or trees bearing fruit in a time of war to make ramparts against your enemy, because man is like a tree in the field. What has the tree done to hurt you? The tree will provide your food, etc. But this term is taken by our sages into many, many directions. And I'll leave it up to the listener to paint their own picture of what is the connection between a man and a tree, a human and a tree. What do they have in common? What is the relationship between us? Of course, immediately you think back to the garden, and we go back to Shavuot, and we go back the tree in the garden, the tree in the garden. In the field, we've been talking about fields and growth and agriculture. Tree is a very core symbol in our religion. In front of my house, there are two enormously high palm trees. That is part of the Muslim tradition. One is male and one is female. And this is planted in front of our house because they guard the house in Muslim tradition. In many of the faith traditions of the world, the tree is a very central feature. In Christianity, you have the Christmas tree that came from other traditions. It's been now integrated into Christianity. We want to re-explore the centrality of the tree in faith-based communities and continue work that has already been started on bringing awareness of the significance of trees, not just as sinks for CO2, but as a religious symbol that is necessary for us to guard on the face of this planet, so that we, as people of faith, will not abuse the wood that comes from trees, the felling of forests unnecessarily, etc., etc. It becomes, a mitzvah, to a divine command, to protect the tree as it was back then in a particular case of in the time of war. Well, we're in a time of war right now. The war is our survival on the planet, or the planet's survival. That's one thing. Another thing that we're going on, that we're working on, is something called the Holy Land Declaration. And this is a declaration that we've written in English, in Hebrew, and Arabic, that in the next few weeks we're going to be taking around the country to religious leaders to have them sign on this as people of faith, whether they're Muslims, whether they're Druze, whether they're Jews, whether they're Christians. There is a statement that says, as a person of faith, I recognize the trouble that we humans have brought upon the face of the earth, that as a person of faith, I recognize that I have a responsibility to protect the earth in the name of religion, in the name of God. And I declare that as a person of faith, I will make the following moves to help protect the planet. We want that to be signed in the Holy Land, but it goes further than that, because the Holy Land is not just this little piece of land, and this is another subject that we can talk about. It's no longer this little piece of land. It is the whole planet is holy. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of everything. The world is filled with His glory. Everything and everywhere. So out of the Holy Land, this piece of land, Terra Sancta, we will try and send this declaration to the entire Holy Land of the planet, and to utilize the tremendous power that lies in the hands of people of faith. One of my colleagues pointed out that it was faith, people of faith, that ended the slave trade. And there's a lot been written about it. A new film recently came out about it. Good Christians, good Muslims, good Jews, people who are not part of the takers, if you want, or recognize that as takers, they're actually outside of the takers, as described before, as I see the Jewish tradition, who are willing and wanting and see the necessity to make a difference as people of faith. So we take the power out, or the exclusive power out of the hands of politicians and corporations, and put it where it should be, people of faith. So that is another initiative that we're taking.
Does that mean that people outside of this particular geography will be able to associate themselves?
Absolutely. There's going to be internet social network, and synagogues will be able to sign up and then find out through the social network that, oh, the mosque down the road, oh, look, they also signed up. And then to rise above our differences and to say, you know what, the planet is in danger. Let's get together and do something about it. And last night I was at an event for Jerusalem Day with Rabbi Menachem Froman at Yakar and Sheikh Hassan Manasri from Nazareth and his father, and talking about the same issue of, can we rise above our differences and touch that point of faith that is above the manifestations of our religions. And so Sufis and Kabbalists can come together and they have a common language. Can regular people of faith who see God as creator of the planet and has bestowed upon us the job of custodians, as we said at the beginning, that we can live. We're given permission to live and spread out upon the planet, but oy vavoy if you damage it. And if you damage it, fix it. We all have that in common. Can we rise above our differences and join hands on that one? That is part of the Jewish Climate Initiative, which, by the way, is JCI, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, amongst others. coming out of A for atheists. Jewish Christians and Islamists, the A for everybody else. But definitely that's an effort that we are beginning to gear up for. And we are in contact with the URI, the United Religions Initiative. I think that's the right URI in the West Coast of America that have started things like this. And there are people doing tree planting and tree awareness around the world, especially in Africa. There's even an effort now by the United Nations called the A Billion Trees. And it was an effort that was started a few years ago but it's faltering. And what we want to do is to wind the motor up again by bringing it back down to the faith, the people of faith, the centrality of the tree, the centrality of the photosynthetic cycle, the responsibility for looking after the planet. So please God, this time next year, I'll have much more to report upon this. In the meantime, I wish everybody a happy Shavuot, a happy remembering of the way it used to be in the garden, a smell and a taste that comes drifting over from the garden into our cheesecake, into our synagogues, into our houses of prayer. This is Pentecost time. This is the giving of Torah. And may we all be blessed to receive the new Torah this time that will motivate us. The Torah comes from God. It's interpreted by us. We have to come up with a new Torah to live in a more healthy way on this planet, whether it be between males and females, men and women, husbands and wives, houses and owners, fields, cattle, maidservant, men servants. We have to learn the ways that will bring greater happiness to this planet.
Thank you, Michael.